For generations, American politicians have promised to reduce or even eliminate poverty. In 1964, President Lyndon Johnson went so far as to declare an unconditional war on poverty. Today's guest warns, however, that the rhetoric of fighting poverty has in reality become a war on the poor, with devastating consequences for America's most vulnerable children. She's Lynette Azy Lessing, this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, scholars, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Lynette Azy Lessing, clinical professor of social work at Boston University and author of Behind from the Start: How America's War on the Poor is Harming Our Most Vulnerable Children. Lynette, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
So we want to talk to you about the book, but we want to talk to you first a little bit. You've actually spent time in the trenches, as it were, working as a social worker prior to your career in higher education.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit, what did you do and where did you do it?
Well, I often say to my students, I started out as a practitioner on the front lines working with kids and families. And as a practitioner, I began to see the limitations of what you can do on the front lines based on what's happening in an organization and what kind of leadership is there, what kind of resources they have. And so I moved into administration. I got involved in starting a nonprofit, primarily for young families with at-risk children, families that were living in poverty, recent immigrant families, and built that in Rhode Island to provide a whole range of services to vulnerable families with young children, and then moved into the policy arena because I saw the limitations of what organizations can do based on funding and policy issues. And so part of my transition from the practice world of social work into social work education was really in part to become involved in policy work and advocacy on behalf of vulnerable young children and their families.
I know that sort of every family situation is going to be unique, but if you think about the period when you were on the front lines, as you said, did you keep running into the same problem again and again and again?
Yes.
Are there sort of a witch's brew of usual suspects, as it were?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's a witch's brew so much as so much red tape. And, you know, I would ask families, you know, what do you need to do a good job of taking care of your children? And time and time again, I would hear about the runaround. That you have to go from one place to another, sometimes take two or three buses to get services, that the services didn't work together and sometimes work against one another. And that continues on, I would think, since the service system has diminished and what we're able to offer families who are struggling has decreased. The safety net has decreased. And the service array has decreased. So I think a lot of it is not only a lack of the appropriate services at the right time, but also how disjointed they often are. I had a friend, when I was describing this, say that's like giving a family a car one part at a time. You know, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work
well. It's a good metaphor. It's a sad metaphor. So you talk about services decreasing over time, and we're talking America in general. What are the factors behind that? What happened when services decreased when you would think they would at least be maintained and probably increased for the betterment of our young people?
Yeah. I think that The American public in general has, bought into a myth that struggling families have it too easy, that, welfare enables people to not work and to live a reasonably comfortable life, and that, lots of families are on welfare, or that women are having more children in order to get a bigger check. And I mean, the reality is, since welfare reform, which was passed under President Clinton in 1996, the safety net has severely diminished. And, yes, welfare reform increased the number of poor parents who are in the workforce. It also increased the number of working poor families in this country. And it increased the number of families in deep poverty. And when we talk about deep poverty, we're talking about a mother and a child living on $8,000-$9,000 a year.
Say that again. A mother and a child living on
$8,000 or $9,000 a year.
For all expenses.
For all expenses. And that's
You can't do that.
Well, I mean, those families get food stamps and other kinds of support.
Still.
And there are 6 million children in our country living in deep poverty, 13 million children living in poverty altogether. And so with the diminishing of particularly cash assistance through welfare reform, it is very, very hard to get cash assistance in any state in this country. And there are strict time limits. There are rules in terms of parents being in job training programs, moving toward work, and so forth. I think most concerning recently, in the Great Recession beginning in 2008, welfare rolls did not dramatically increase because states weren't spending money on that.
And yet these myths persist.
Yes.
If anything, they've intensified in the last few years, given the political climate in this country. Why do these myths persist? I mean, we see it now in the immigration debate, too.
Yes.
People want to come here for the free benefits, and that's the only reason somebody might want to come to America.
Yes.
Why? Well, what's?
Well, I think a lot of it began during the Reagan administration. Not to blame one person or one politician, because there are certainly lots of places to point the finger. But that was the beginning of the whole trope of the welfare queens.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. And people come
driving the Cadillac and
to pick up their food stamps and so forth.
All that nonsense, right? And yeah. Standing in line with lobster and steak and all that nonsense.
And that has endured. That's been a very strong image. It's based largely on myth, not to media bash, but.
That's
okay.
Media needs bashing sometimes, believe me.
Yeah, I hear, and this is part of my motivation for writing my book, is that, I would hear on the radio about a parent on welfare who traded their food stamps for drugs. And you would hear this, during the course of the day on the radio station 5 or 6 times, this one case. But when you look at the kind of cheating that goes on, even in the in our tax system, the IRS loses hundreds of millions of dollars every year to people underreporting income and cheating on their taxes, and even that dwarfs compared to cheating and dishonesty in military contracts and Pentagon contracts and so forth. And so whatever cheating goes on with cash assistance, food stamps, benefits for poor families is such small potatoes in comparison. And yet we hear so much about people collecting more than their share and so forth.
We talked a little bit about sort of like that myth of the welfare queen. What's the reality? What's the reality that you've seen with the people that you've worked with?
The reality is often a young woman who grew up in our foster care system, who was shuttled from foster home to foster home, may well have been sexually abused before she was moved into foster care, has been in 4, 5, 6 different school systems, reading at maybe a 5th or 6th grade level, has a child and is struggling with mental health issues. She might be medicating herself with drugs or alcohol. She's never gotten good mental health services. She's trying to take care of her child. She's living in a dangerous neighborhood. She's isolated because of the high crime rate there. And someone like that needs all the support that we can give them. They don't need to be called out. They don't need to be shamed. They need support. They need education services, mental health services, maybe substance abuse services.
You mentioned shame, and one of the things that strikes me about these debates is that quite often there's a meanness.
Yes.
They people don't work hard enough, or they somehow they are less deserving.
Or it's their own fault. It's, or
yes. Exactly.
If they could just, pick themselves up by their bootstraps.
Yes. And I say, what about people who don't have any boots? And I think, the example that I just gave, where do you begin to pick yourself up? All of us, or at least 98% of us who are successful in our careers and our lives and so forth, we had lots of nurturance and supports along the way to get where we are. And yet for people who don't have those things, we somehow expect them to rise above in a way that the rest of us probably couldn't.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Lynette Azy Lessing. After 25 years in the field as a social worker and child advocate, Lynette finds herself now educating a new generation as clinical professor of social work at Boston University. She's also the author of an important new book, Behind from the Start: How America's War on the Poor is Harming Our Most Vulnerable Children. Dr. Azy Lessing is on Twitter at LALESSING.
So there's almost an innate selfishness about that. Like, we're not all in this together.
Yes.
We're not our brother's keepers.
Yeah, we're not all one society. I mean, granted, we have many differences, but we are one society. Mm-hmm. We're the American society. It sort of infuriates me. You talk about a number of factors. This young woman who has a child, this young woman who herself as a child went from foster home to foster home, was traumatized, who had poor mental health influences, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So that perpetuates itself.
Yes,
without
it does.
Intervention.
Without intervention. And so, if we're really about breaking the cycle, and keep in mind, the United States has the highest poverty rate of any similarly developed country. And of course, we are the richest country in the world as well.
Yeah.
But we have 13 million children living in poverty, 6 million living in deep poverty. If you wanted to break that cycle, it would seem to me that what you would want to do is invest resources in that family, that young, fragile family, support that young woman to finish her education, get the skills necessary for a good job, at the same time that you're supporting her as a parent of a young child, and help that young child get off to the best possible start so that that child goes to school ready to learn with his or her needs met, and can be successful and grow up in a way that's different than the parent grew up.
So that's a positive for the child.
It's very positive,
but
yes.
It's also a positive for the society.
Yes, it is.
Because that child who is traumatized, who is living in poverty with all these influences, the violent neighborhood, the drugs, or whatever, that child goes on to become an adult.
That's right, and a self-supporting adult, and somebody who contributes to our economy. Right now, child poverty is estimated to cost us over $1 trillion a year in lost productivity, in crime, in additional special education and mental health costs.
Say the amount again.
$1 trillion a year.
$1 trillion.
Yes.
So even if you don't have a particularly large heart, you can look at the economics of this and say, well, that makes sense.
Well, the economics are crystal clear, yes. There's a report that's come out in the past year by the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine They had a special task force with the challenge of answering the question, what would it take to cut child poverty in the United States in half in a 10-year period? And this group met some of the top economists, psychologists, social workers, developmental people in the country. They met for a number of months, and they came up with a number of scenarios. For instance, one of the key scenarios was if you increased good quality programs that helped poor parents get from where they are into good jobs, if you increased the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit to put more cash in the pockets of poor families, and you know a couple of other things, expand the number of housing vouchers and so forth that, that people have access to, you could cut child poverty in half in a 10-year period, and it would cost, you know, the numbers aren't low. It would cost $90 to $100 billion. But $100 billion is only 10% of the $1 trillion a year that child poverty costs us.
That's a pretty good return on investment.
Very good return on investment.
So your book is Behind from the Start, How America's War on the Poor is Harming Our Most Vulnerable Children. The thing that struck me about that is you talk about a war on the poor.
Yes.
And typically in American politics, we talk about a war on poverty, going back to Lyndon Johnson.
Yes.
Talk to us about that turn of phrase and why you picked that.
Well, it is a turn of phrase of the war on poverty. And in the 1960s, Americans were scandalized as TV cameras pointed towards Appalachia and other parts of the country, some of our urban areas, where people were living in abject poverty. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is as our country is continuing to become, in the 60s, more industrialized and technology focused and so forth. And under Lyndon Johnson, there was a big push to do something about that. And so, you know, we had programs like Medicaid and Head Start and housing and housing vouchers and so forth. And the whole idea was acknowledging that poverty was a cycle and that it needed to be broken. And that, you know, if you gave people help in pulling themselves up, that they could do it. And many did. Our safety net programs actually significantly reduce the amount of people who live in poverty, whether it's food stamps or Medicaid, whether it's cash assistance. Housing certainly helps a lot of people stay out of poverty. But over time, that faded. And again, you know, especially beginning in the Reagan administration, there was a whole different story being put out there. And it was that we've been too generous with people, they're too dependent, that somehow giving family assistance and benefits was undermining marriage. Because if it was a two-parent family, there was the expectation that the father would be in the workforce and so forth. And instead of fine-tuning those programs and bringing them up to date, the reaction by government was to cut them and to demonize the people that depend upon them.
We're not attacking poverty anymore. We're literally attacking the poor.
Attacking poor people, yes. And it's, you know, it's not just, you know, when people think about the poor, they tend to think about people in urban areas. They tend to think about people of color in particular, even though most poor people in our country are white. There are a lot of poor people living in urban areas. There are also a lot of working poor people living in the South, living in rural areas. And I think our politicians, unfortunately, have pit those two groups together, white working poor people and urban poor people who are often of color. And I think as long as you keep the groups at the bottom fighting, as long as you keep working poor people thinking, you know, that other people are getting away with something and are getting benefits that they're not entitled to, it allows the people at the top, you know, to continue to get away with murder in terms of low taxes and low, decreased regulation and all of that. And hence inequality is increased.
Your book gets into something I found fascinating, which is the neuroscience of the young developing brain, really starting from birth. Talk about the impact, and it's really brilliantly done. Talk about the impact of these factors, poverty and the associated factors that we have discussed here, on the developing brain, and
yes,
how it changes the brain and what the long-term effects are. And this, yeah, we could do an hour on this alone.
We could, yes. Yes,
and so
we,
in five, yeah, seconds. Thank you.
No, we have two more than five.
All right.
And I want to get on the table and shout about that, because, you know, we should be sounding an alarm about this. We now know that poverty is poison, and poverty in early life in particular. You know, I call poverty in early life a perfect storm of risk factors. We used to believe that, you know, children, babies were born with most of their brains already formed. Mm. But what the exploding science of neuroscience has taught us is that much of the human brain develops in the first 4 years of life. And so those babies, those toddlers, those preschoolers, the actual architecture, the circuitry, if you will, of their brains is in the process of being formed. So someone's capacity to learn, to succeed in school, to be a good employee, to love well, to have good relationships, to be a good parent someday, that capacity is being formed rapidly in those early years of brain development. And so, you know, when children are growing up in abject poverty, and young children, children under six, are more likely to be poor in our country than any other age group, hence, you know, the alarm we should be sending. They aren't getting the nutrition that they need. They're not getting the stimulation and the early learning that they need, especially if they have a parent who is overwhelmed, if they're living in a violent community, if they don't have a lot of social supports around them. Those families are dealing with a lot of stress and trauma. And so, you know, we hear a lot about this now, toxic stress. We know that children who are growing up in high stress environments where they're not getting the kinds of nurturing and stimulation that they need, their brains are being flooded with stress hormones that actually change how that brain is developing and actually affecting the capacity to learn. We also know that children who are left with caregivers that aren't giving them a lot of attention, or parked in front of the television because there's no funding for good quality early care and education, there are actual parts of their brain that aren't forming, because so much of early brain development has to do with this positive sort of response between children and their caregivers and stimulation. And so education inequality begins really at birth in terms of the kinds of environments children are growing up in, poor children are growing up in the early years of their lives.
So when you think about, what do we do about this? What do we do about this?
Well, you know, I think we have to take a multi-pronged approach, as I outlined in the book. And I do think one part of it is changing the narrative. I do think that a part of this is educating the public that, you know, these tropes and stereotypes of people, whether you're calling them welfare queens or for working poor families in rural areas, hillbillies, you know, that's not productive, and it hurts the cause. It really hurts our ability to come up with solutions.
It's dehumanizing too, it seems.
It is, and when we dehumanize people, we're less invested,
right,
in helping to make their lives better, right? And then teaching people the cost of not doing enough. You know, $1 trillion a year that we lose.
It's a staggering number.
It is
a staggering number.
It's
truly staggering.
And the cost relative to what it would take to turn things around. And that it can't be, I mean, sometimes people get in arguments, should we just give people money, or is it all about services and supports? And it has to be both. It has to be comprehensive. But, you know, with time limits, with shortages of services, with the fragmentation between services, you know, it's very difficult to deliver something that's comprehensive and long-lasting, and will help truly lift families out of poverty rather than putting a Band-Aid on it.
Another suggestion you have, and it doesn't necessarily, at least on first glance, sound like a child-related issue, is reform our unjust, family-destroying criminal justice
yes.
system. Talk about that, because that is absolutely key, and,
yes.
and a wonderful part of the book to point that out.
Well, you know, again, and the time frame is the same in terms of, you know, when we began using different language to describe poor families. We also started with what was called the major war on crime, war on drugs. And as we know now, those programs unfairly and hugely, in a huge way, disproportionately targeted families of color. And families of color, particularly African American families in our country, are disproportionately poor. And so when you are incarcerating a large percentage of the men in any group, you and incarcerating them unfairly, meaning these long, incredibly long, harsh sentences for relatively modest drug offenses, which is what happened in the war on drugs.
And still happens.
It's not only, you know, unfair, unjust, but it also is depriving children of a father, depriving families perhaps of a breadwinner. It is setting back those men in terms of their ability to progress in careers, and it helps to fuel the cycle, because what are the, you know, the children of someone who is incarcerated are deprived of that parental relationship. They're also deprived of the income that that parent would bring in. And so they're more likely to grow up poor and not do well in school. And not doing well in school is a risk factor for becoming involved in crime as well.
We've got literally about 20 seconds left here.
Ah.
So it's not fair to ask this question. But if you're a concerned citizen, if this is the kind of thing that you're passionate about,
uh-huh.
what can a citizen do about this set of issues?
A couple of different things. One is to educate your friends and your neighbors, to correct people when they talk about welfare queens and people lying around the house watching big screen TV collecting a government check. That is myth and needs to be corrected. And to let our elected officials know we need a bigger safety net, not a smaller one. A small safety net sets families up for failure. If we provided the right supports at the right time for families, we could break this cycle, and we could do it in a relatively short amount of time. People need to speak up.
It's a great place to leave it. She's Lynette Azy-Lessing. The book is Behind From the Start. Thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have. He's Wayne. I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for Story in the Public Square.